Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. The parents of Matthew Shepard recently returned to Laramie, and we hear what it's like to be back.
But there's always that background of the conspiracy that lingers here, and that's really hard. It's hard when you know that some people wish you just would go away.
This week, the Cody School Board decided to allow teachers to carry guns in school.
I feel more comfortable being around these teachers with guns than I do a lot of the other people just because they've gone through it. They know what they're supposed to be doing.
And a story about a new policy that significantly reduces public input and review for oil and gas leases on BLM land.
This is exactly the kind of document or memorandum that really cries out for the public to be engaged.
Join us for these stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Cody is now the second school district in Wyoming to put guns in the hands of teachers and staff. Unlike Uinta County School District No. 1, which passed the policy in 2 months, Park County School District No. 6 took well over 8 months. But what now? Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kadelska explains.
For Jessica Case, a parent in the district, the night of the third and final vote was anticlimactic.
I don't think any of us were surprised that the policy passed.
The policy was first introduced to the school board in the fall by one board member. Case says it seems streamlined.
And I was kind of shocked the first time I went to the meeting because I thought, well, where's the discussion where we go big and we look at all the options and we consider, is this a good idea or a bad idea? It was immediately a policy that people were debating.
That other option or compromise Case and others had hoped for was more school resource officers, or SROs. These are police officers patrolling schools. Kelly Simone, the board chair, says that arming teachers wasn't her first choice either, but when the school board looked at the possibility of more SROs, it's expensive. For instance, one SRO costs between $50,000 to $75,000 per year.
Most people don't know that the district and the city of Cody cost share the school resource officer. And so for it to be financially sustainable, it would have to be sustainable for both governmental entities.
At a time of education budget cuts, that would be difficult to pay for. Simone says the board has also updated the safety of the school buildings themselves. This includes reinforced windows and doors, one point of entry, and video surveillance. Lucille Sachs is a senior at Cody High School, and she says updating the school's infrastructure is a better path to follow.
Even though we live in a society where we are worried about our safety at school, you shouldn't add fire to that by adding a firearm to that.
But Cody Edwards, a fellow senior, doesn't agree. He's convinced that wouldn't work. He says the school has performed active shooter drills that prove they need someone on the premises with a gun.
I myself would have died if that was a real situation, and we should be trying to get to someone who has a gun, which is eventually what we're going to do anyway if we're calling the police or a resource officer.
Now that the board has passed the policy, the next steps are to pick a vendor for a trainer and a psychological exam provider. Once this is completed, teachers can start applying to carry firearms. The board foresees teachers carrying by the beginning of the next school year. This means the teacher completed a psychological evaluation, a drug and alcohol test, and at least 18 hours of training. Flint Flesher is a father of 4 kids in the district and the owner of Alpine Firearms Training. He says, in Cody, you're constantly surrounded by people carrying guns in public.
I feel more comfortable being around these teachers with guns than I do a lot of the other people just because they've gone through it. They know what they're supposed to be doing.
The other fact is that teachers who will be allowed to carry must have already had a concealed carry permit for 2 years, so they should already be experienced with a gun. In contrast, as Cody officially puts away its gun-free zone signs, Powell, the school district next door, has decided to keep theirs after not moving forward with their own gun policy. For Jennifer Case, who we met in the beginning, this could be a game changer for her seventh grader.
Potentially in high school, he would go to Powell if this continues to be a policy.
But for now, she's optimistic that the controversial topic of arming teachers has opened conversation in the community, and there could be potential for changes in the future. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska from the Center of the West in Cody.
At the recent Matthew Shepard Symposium at the University of Wyoming, protesters gathered with signs denouncing the LGBTQ community. The group was from the Westboro Baptist Church in Topeka, and nearly 20 years ago, they also picketed Matthew Shepard's funeral. But inside the symposium, a former Westboro Baptist Church member was preparing to speak. She was there to explain that when she started engaging in civil dialogue over Twitter, her entire worldview changed. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards sat down with Megan Phelps Roper as part of her series, I Respectfully Disagree.
So I grew up at the Westboro Baptist Church, and one of the doctrines was that we celebrated death and tragedy as God's punishment on sinners who deserved every evil that befell them. And so when Matthew Shepard was killed, I was 12 years old, and my sister and I were rushed home from school because they were going to leave immediately to go and protest the funeral. And my sister, it was her turn to go to that protest. And I remember being very upset, not because of the murder, but because of the fact that it wasn't my turn to go and protest the funeral.
Phelps Roper was one of 10 children, and her grandfather established the church. From toddlers, the kids all attended rallies, waving signs that read things like, "Thank God for AIDS." Her mother managed a law office conducting church business, and Phelps Roper grew up to be her mother's assistant.
I was all in on everything that the church believed, all of their doctrines. I wasn't at Matthew Shepard's funeral, and I never protested the trial when my family went to protest the trial also. But I did participate in a lot of protests against the Matthew Shepard Foundation in Colorado, and then also productions of the Laramie Project at high schools and universities all across the country. I thought it was evil and wrong what they were doing, lionizing this person that, you know, was a sinner, who was an abominable sinner against God.
And so then something happened that kind of changed that. Can you talk about what happened next?
I was 23 when I got on Twitter, so I'd been picketing for almost, you know, coming up on 2 decades, and was a very strong believer. You know, consulting with, you know, a cousin and then my mom and a few other people, took our message to Twitter. I just sent an attempt to reach more people and, you know, utilize this new technology as a way of propagating our message. And what ended up happening was that I was changed far more than anyone. I didn't change anybody else, I don't think.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't bring anybody over to our way of thinking. But so I started having conversations there. And they were different from the picket line in that on the picket line, like, you have very little time with people. There's a lot of hostility and animosity, and they're very short. So there's just no time to develop rapport. And also in physical space, there's this element of, like, physical danger as well. And so being online, being on Twitter, and having these, you know, ongoing kind of constant conversations with outsiders, I'm coming to see them as human beings. Because it's online, I'm also more vulnerable to their ideas because I feel safe. I shouldn't say more vulnerable to their ideas. Like, I mean, I just mean I was open to hearing them in a way that I was not in person.
You engaged in an actual dialogue.
There was a
sense of, like, you were being able to hear them and were maybe feeling heard as well.
Absolutely. Both sides of that. I mean, it's absolutely true. It's because they were asking questions and they're, again, trying to get to the root of our ideas and understand them. You know, I felt heard, and I also felt because they were asking questions, I could ask them questions too. Because they took that time to understand Westboro's message, they were able to find contradictions in our ideas that I had never seen. Even when I was really trying, like on the picket line or especially like to journalists, I would spend so much time talking to people and really trying to get them to understand our way of thinking. And then I would see the articles come out, even when I had spent literally months talking to a reporter. And I would see the article and I'd be like, wow, they totally don't get it. And so Twitter, because it became a dialogue, like, they could understand me and I could understand them.
So, and then you formed some pretty personal relationships on Twitter as well.
That's true. One of them ended up becoming my husband.
Some of her rhetoric was anti-Semitic. And what's so incredible about this marriage is that her husband is Jewish.
He's my favorite person. Yeah. I just, I'm sorry, as soon as you mentioned this, like, I just start grinning ear to ear. Like, he, you know, I mentioned earlier about the emotional impact. Like, I had become desensitized to the emotional impact of what we were doing to other people. And my husband was one of those people who was really, because of the way he was engaging me and you know, very kindly challenging me to really think about what we were doing to other people and forcing me to look at something that I had long ignored. It was so terrible because I, you know, once I realized I had feelings for him, I had to totally cut off contact with him. I felt like, you know, it would be the end of the world. Like I couldn't leave. I was not going to go down this evil path. And it was more than a year after that after I stopped speaking to him that I left the church.
Phelps Roper left with her younger sister, knowing they would never see their family again. Her mother's parting words were, "You know, you can always come back."
And how does it feel to be at the Matthew Shepherd Symposium?
I am so overwhelmed right now. The grace and the compassion that people have shown me. I was sitting, you know, yesterday before the event, and I was sitting down in the front row, and a gentleman sat next to me, and he told me his 71st birthday was last week, and wanted to tell me, "Welcome to Laramie," and that the shepherds had stayed with him during the trial, stayed at his house. Mm-hmm. And to hear the words, "Welcome to Laramie," it just is unreal. And then to know, come to understand who he was and to hear these incredibly kind things that he was saying and to hear him and other people describe the healing that they feel in having this conversation, it mirrors how I feel, but I'm so impossibly grateful. I'm so overwhelmed. I hardly have words and I feel so inarticulate, but I'm so glad and grateful to be here.
To hear Megan Phelps Roper's TED Talk about her life and her four guidelines for bridging divides, visit the Wyoming Public Media website. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
When we come back, Matthew Shepherd's parents join me for an interesting conversation. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. 20 years ago this fall, an openly gay University of Wyoming student was robbed, tied to a fence, brutally beaten, and left for dead on the outskirts of Laramie. He died a few days later. The murder of Matthew Shepherd was called a hate crime by local law enforcement officers, and it led to worldwide attention on the topic of LGBTQ rights. His parents, Dennis and Judy Shepherd, remain residents of Wyoming and have dedicated themselves to fight discrimination in the name of their son. They spent a lot of time in Laramie during their youth, and I asked them to describe what it's like to return to Laramie.
It's pretty amazing. I'm not used to seeing a remodeled student union, and I'm not used to seeing everybody with a laptop sitting in there. At the same time, I think about Matt. It's hard to get away from thinking about his last hours and the fun that he had before that, how much he enjoyed being here and how much he wanted to come back here and finish school. So it's a real mixed blessing.
My guess is you've come back to a lot of support and maybe some old friends and people probably very excited to see you and hear from you. And I imagine that adds to the mixed blessings.
Well, that's true. We have friends here and we do come back for support from the people we know who know the story. But there's always that background of the conspiracy that lingers here. And that's really hard. It's hard when you know that some people wish you just would go away. What's hard for me is I was here most of the time in 99 when the trials were taking place. Dennis only came back for the end of the both of them. So this holds a different set of memories for me. It's really hard.
You went a direction I wanted to ask you about. Obviously, there was a book that came out, and there's an alternative viewpoint on Matt and how Matt died. How has that been to hear and deal with?
Well, so let's just get a few facts out of the way right away. This conspiracy of theirs was a drug deal gone bad, right? Well, so if it was, why didn't they say so? Why in their own statements did those two young men say it was because Matt was gay? Why did they not say we were buying drugs and all that? That would have made everything so different and so much less interesting to the media, right?
Mm-hmm.
So much less interesting. So if that was the case, why didn't they just say so? There have been a lot of theories about communities who just absolutely refuse to believe their community is responsible for this kind of thing. And I sort of feel like that's what Wyoming does, is they just don't want to acknowledge it does happen here. It does happen here. It still happens here. So the ridiculousness of all of it is just very irritating to me, because intellectually people should know this is ridiculous.
Dennis?
Well, you have to understand the background. The person who wrote the book was the producer of the 2020 show with Elizabeth Vargas that was such a flop. And his dream was to become a big-time producer. And when that didn't happen, he wrote this book, and it's a book of paranoia. And it was published, no mainstream publisher would publish it. He had to go to a conspiracy theory publisher to get it out. The sad part is that the Wyoming Historical Society, without ever vetting the book, gave it an award and legitimized it. And I happened to be there for another reason, and I jumped all over them. And they were embarrassed, but they didn't know what to do. And I said, because we have the people here in town, like Sheriff O'Malley, who actually investigated Matt's incident and can verify and prove everything, along with Tim Newcomb, who has vehemently denied everything that was in that conspiracy book. And he did so in the Laramie Boomerang. So this is his way of trying to get fame and fortune, and the sad thing is it's out there now. So later on, people will see this and think this is the true story and not know that Judy's book is really more about it. And then the facts of the trial, all the testimony in there that verifies it, as Judy said, they flat denied even knowing Matt before that night. And they've done it again and again.
Like I said before, why would they not use that as their defense?
Well, they said in the book that it was because they were afraid that they'd be tortured and beaten and killed in prison. Bull.
Yeah, sounds good.
We are visiting with Dennis and Judy Shepherd. It's the 20-year anniversary of the murder of Matthew Shepherd. I asked my newsroom, they're all 20-somethings, and many of them don't remember this case.
Sure.
They certainly are aware of it because they do work in Laramie, Wyoming. And I said, what question would you like to ask? And one of the questions that they wanted to ask you was, humanize Matt for me. What was he like?
Pain in the butt.
Yeah. He was argumentative, very outspoken, certain in his positions, politically obsessed. He loved the theater, funny. Diminutive in size, loved a good joke, loved people, never met a stranger. He thrived on new experiences, new people, new stories, new foods, new everything. He wanted to absorb everything about life. But there was a side to him that was also sort of reserved. He had been assaulted in high school in overseas, and that sort of changed him from being an extreme extrovert into being a more cautious introvert. But he still was very much out there for meeting anybody new. He was delightful and argumentative.
Pain in the butt, Dennis?
He just loved to argue. And so I'd say the sky is blue, and by the time we get done arguing, I agree with him that it was green. So just to give up.
It was very much in the Democratic platform of social safety net, taking
social
care
issues,
of,
he was really
justice, social injustice, justice, taking care of people, treating everybody the same, equality. All of that has always been, even when he was small.
And I think it really opened his eyes up with that after going overseas and seeing how some of the workers from foreign countries were treated in Saudi Arabia, and other parts of the world where he visited.
So here we are 20 years later. How do you see how the world has changed? Part of you has to feel, I would think, that there has been some improvement, but I wonder if the other part of you is like, have we made any progress whatsoever?
You know, we spent a lot of time during the Bush administration working at the grassroots level, trying to raise awareness, change hearts and minds, tell our stories, just to familiarize people with the gay community, let them know how many of us there really are. And that we're just people. We're your coworker, your neighbor, your friend, your son, your cousin. And then when Obama became president, we all felt in this social justice movement of all disenfranchised folks that we had an opportunity to work with someone who understood social justice and injustice, who had experienced it, who it was part of his culture, and the people he had around him were of the same ilk. Well, things just for everybody just went lickety-split through his administration in acknowledging disparity and trying to raise equality, equity. We got rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We have marriage equality, hate crime legislation signed in that takes care of sexual orientation, federal, even in Wyoming. So, yes, we made so much progress. And not just that, but the role model that this man was for the world changed things internationally dramatically. So it was wonderful. And then, 2016 election, it's like, oh my God, what have we done? I just see every day things being turned backwards, trying to change this back into what it was.
But, and I want to add this, but when I see these policy changes take place, and use the transgender and the military one as a recent example, what you also hear are the people that are in the military reacting to that. And I wonder if you'd comment on that.
Yes, that is the brilliant thing. Also, courts are now, they are more on, in view of preserving those rights that we had and preserving them.
Those are the old judges, not the new ones coming in under the present administration. That's the scary part.
Yeah, we'll see. So, for example, the immigration ban. Well, they said no. The judges said no, the trans in the military. But what we also have accomplished in the Obama administration was organization, acknowledgement, numbers, a awareness of who we are, all the marginalized communities. We have a voice now, and we know how to use it, and we are using it.
Back to your son. One of the things that still happens to me from time to time is I will get a letter from a kid, or I'll get, it's usually an email, and they'll say, Mr. Beck, I'm going to be in the play, The Laramie Project, and I wonder if you could give me a little sense of you know, how I should play this particular character or something like that. 20 years later, this play is still being done in high schools, mm-hmm. colleges, all across the country. How does that make you feel?
I'm so grateful to Moises and Tectonic for creating this amazing piece of theater. Of history, of honesty. It's not only performed nationally, but internationally as well. But if we took out Matt and his sexuality and inserted an immigrant or a dreamer, it's the exact same story, exact same story. It's about the disenfranchised. It's about how we are not treating people, human beings, the way we should and not respecting who they are. But it just, I am amazed and thrilled and so proud of them.
The sad part to me is that this play is still relevant.
Have you seen any change in Laramie or in Wyoming since that time on attitudes?
Yeah. We have GSAs now in the high schools, which is something I really question would ever happen, gay-straight alliances, thriving gay-straight alliances. There's not a population base to really support a gay bar or center, but each community finds their own way to gather and support each other. Casper had their first actual parade last year. They've had pride events, but not a parade.
In fact, the tutu comment?
The tutu thing was brilliant, right? That was brilliant. I do see progress, but like the very next day, we had that awful thing with Kathy Connolly and the trying to change the language in forms. That was heartbreaking to me that some people are still there. So
there's still work to be done?
Still work to be done everywhere.
Judy, Dennis Shepherd, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you. Appreciate the invitation.
When we come back, we'll hear the results of a survey conducted on the UW campus regarding sexual violence. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. The hashtag MeToo movement might have given the impression that disclosures of sexual violence are more out in the open. But clinical psychology professor Matt Gray says in actuality, very few survivors officially report what they've experienced. And that's true at the University of Wyoming as well. Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson spoke with Gray, who recently completed a campus climate survey looking at the prevalence of sexual misconduct on campus.
So where does your sense that people aren't making official reports but that sexual violence is happening, where does that come from?
People don't realize that here and everywhere else in America, the great majority of sexual assault survivors do not report. And the good thing about the survey that we used, it's a nationally used, the most widely used survey of sexual assault experiences on college campuses. It asks about who have you disclosed to. And we can see that 10% of survivors haven't told anybody. And we can see that of survivors who have told somebody, the great majority, not surprisingly when you think about it, have told close friends or roommates or romantic partners or parents or guardians or other family members.
And what is the percentage of people that indicated they told a friend?
89.9% of our sexual assault survivors in this survey indicated that they had reported to a close friend. So 10% of survivors are not even telling their closest friend that this has happened to them. And if we look at roommate, that drops down to 50%. Somebody you live with, if they were assaulted, you have a coin flip chance of them having disclosed to you or knowing anything about it. By the time you start to get to campus entities, be they dean of students, campus therapists, which I am, those numbers are pretty small. We see about 10% of people have reported. And so we just have to recognize that the number of people who come through our door formally with one of these experiences pales in comparison to the number of people who've experienced sexual violence. What we can and should do is do everything that we can to make visible mechanisms to report, make evident resources and information that might be available should they report.
Currently, UW has a campaign called Report It. That centers around a website with an overwhelming amount of information. On the flip side, the more concise flyer about sexual misconduct from the Dean of Students Office gives a web address for a document outlining what to expect from the investigation process, but that document doesn't exist.
But even if we quadrupled the number of people that were reporting formally to campus entities, be they therapists or dean of students or who have you, we would still not be capturing the majority of sexual assault survivors.
And if UW successfully got more survivors to come forward, who would respond? Right now, there's one full-time advocate on staff, one full-time investigator in the Dean of Students office. There are two people in the Title IX office who can respond to reports of sexual violence, but they also handle cases of all kinds of gender discrimination for a campus with close to 18,000 students, staff, and faculty. Gray says climate surveys help universities to see those kinds of blind spots.
I know that you are still analyzing this data, but from the first pass that you've done, what would you say are the big takeaways so far?
So our findings are largely consistent with what we see at most other universities.
So what are we looking at?
So the broad definition of sexual assault is going to be any type of non-consensual sexual contact to include groping, touching, on up to completed rape. Those numbers are typical of most universities, but unfortunately staggering. If we look at all those different variants, all those different types of sexual assault, campus body as a whole, about 27% of respondents are reporting having experienced one of those types of sexual assault. With women, this is 34%. With men, it's 13%. And gender nonconforming, 50%. To contextualize those, there's some universities that are higher than us. There's some that are lower. They're all kind of in that range. But still, in my view, if you're talking about a low of 15% on up to a high of 40%, and most places somewhere in the 20s, that's what we see when we do sexual violence research. That is the nature of sexual assault prevalence on college campuses.
And I think oftentimes examinations of this issue are approached by asking survivors what they've experienced. Mm-hmm. What do we know from your data about perpetrators on campus?
So those rates are, like other universities, seemingly quite low.
The numbers are low, Gray explained, because even with anonymous surveys, perpetrators are still reluctant to admit criminal behavior. And because sexual violence is often caused by a lack of knowledge of consent, people don't see their actions as violations.
We have 3% of males that, if asked about specific types of sexual assault perpetration, did acknowledge that they have engaged in one or more of these behaviors on at least one occasion. But if you extrapolate those numbers across males and females who acknowledge having engaged in some type of non-consensual behavior, that rate is 1.8%. But if you look at what that number would be, given that we had 2,000 people in our sample and there's 10,000 people on campus, that would be the equivalent of 173 people who acknowledge that they have done some type of non-consensual perpetration in their time at the University of Wyoming. And to the extent that most of those people probably haven't perpetrated against just one individual, the number gets pretty big pretty quickly. That's a perfect example of how a seemingly small number should certainly be something that we're concerned about.
So far, Gray has released the preliminary results to UW's Sexual Violence Prevention and Education Task Force. He predicts the final analysis will be available in early June, and he'll be watching closely to see what the University of Wyoming does with that information. But he's optimistic prevention efforts will improve. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
A new policy is changing how the public can weigh in on oil and gas leasing. The Bureau of Land Management is speeding up the process for energy companies. But some are concerned it's at the cost of adequate public input, environmental review, and local power. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
For the past 8 years, whenever a parcel of land was nominated to be leased by an oil and gas company, the Bureau of Land Management went through a significant review period. There were site visits, comments when draft environmental assessments were released, and an additional 30 days of public comment once the sale was live. But a National BLM Acting Assistant Director, Tim Spisak, says all that just wasn't efficient for energy production.
You've gotten virtually every parcel that is offered is being protested.
So in late January, the BLM updated its oil and gas leasing policy to incentivize more drilling on public lands.
So we're trying to find a more streamlined way to get parcels developed.
According to instructions sent to local BLM offices, streamlining that process included reducing public comment from 30 days to 10 on a given lease, limiting postponements of leases, and importantly, in speeding up the whole thing, cutting the timeline from around 16 months to 6 to bring a parcel from nomination to sale. In short, Spisak says the goal is to increase how many leases go up for sale on BLM land to push more production from oil and gas companies.
They need a certain amount of inventory of oil and gas leases out there to be able to develop their plays. And so having that inventory provided will lead to more production.
And it has increased inventory already. The first sale of the updated policy in Wyoming will yield about double the nominated parcels they've seen in the recent past. This policy has environmental advocates concerned. Nada Culver is director of the Wilderness Society's BLM Action Center. She says it means much less in-depth reviews.
We're no longer requiring site visits. We're no longer requiring environmental analysis. We're no longer requiring consultation and time to talk to surface owners or state agencies or the public.
And public comments won't just be shorter, but likely after environmental reviews are already done. Culver says one cost of less public input is challenging problematic leases
I think what we're seeing in Wyoming is certainly parcels nominated and some sold in important sage-grouse habitat within wildlife migration corridors, within crucial winter range. If those sales do go through and if they are, you know, not successfully challenged, then we will eventually start to see the impacts on the ground.
Though there are rules in place to govern, say, how companies develop on sensitive sage-grouse habitat, Culver says advocates will have to be much more vigilant in holding developers accountable. Another change in the policy weakens the ability to defer leases and moves power to the national BLM office. Before this policy, state offices could sign off on postponing a lease if, say, a community was working on how land would be used. This is a problem for mule deer advocate Josh Corsi, who says there's been 20 years of collaborative work on a region in southwest Wyoming.
Hunters, anglers, drillers, miners, hikers have all worked together to try to maintain this special place.
And he fears this will end those collaborative efforts and likely end in leasing for the first time in years with almost 1 million nominated acres.
This is exactly the kind of document or memorandum that really cries out for the public to be engaged.
That's Mark Squillaci, a law professor at the University of Colorado Boulder. In addition to the environmental concerns, Squillaci believes there are legal issues with the updates. He says he doesn't think this policy will be great for oil and gas either. If lease sales are rushed into, there could be mistakes or problems that land the BLM and a company in court.
I think they're just inviting more challenges and problems for their decisions.
But not surprisingly, oil and gas advocates welcome the change. After all, president of the Western Energy Alliance, Kathleen Scamma, saw the former policy as overburdensome, killing lease sales through paralysis by analysis.
Anything that can be done to make that time frame more predictable is welcome, because for years, companies can't even move forward at all if they don't have a lease.
Scamma says environmental review and public input is still happening, and that this leasing process is just the first step in a long line of analysis. For now, field offices are preparing 2 lease sales at once, with the new policy doubling auctions per district office. Scamma, Culver, and even Governor Matt Mead's office accept that the true challenges and successes of the policy will be more apparent when the first sale occurs this coming December. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Gun regulation is currently a hot topic as school shootings keep on grabbing national attention. In order to take a step back and understand where we are now as a country with gun regulation, Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska spoke with 2 gun historians. We start off the conversation speaking with David Coppell. He's the research director at the Independence Institute at the University of Denver, about when gun control started in the United States.
Early on, in some senses, the Virginia colony was chartered in 1606, and the settlement started in 1607. Like most of the colonies that later developed, they had gun controls that mandated gun ownership by every head of a household.
I imagine post-Civil War, were there any big gun regulation changes?
I mean, gun control had existed. You know, a city might have a law against, like, don't shoot a gun off, you know, within city limits. And so after the Civil War, the objective of the former slave states was they accepted that slavery was over. But they tried to keep slavery going in a de facto by enacting laws that were modeled on the slave codes. This is a time in the 1870s and 1880s when Tennessee and Arkansas are actually the center of gun control in the United States. And so they said, we ban all handguns except the Army and Navy model. And of course, you know, the former Confederate officers, they had their high quality handguns, mm-hmm. and, you know, people who could afford to buy a really good gun could afford to buy one. But poorer people, you know, maybe they couldn't afford such a nice handgun. The effect of them was to price them out of the handgun market intentionally.
Were there any social movements that influenced gun regulations? So I'm kind of thinking also of mass migration into cities.
One social movement was the Ku Klux Klan, the not only America's first domestic terrorist organization, but also our first gun control group. They were ex-Confederate soldiers and had horses, which gave them mobility. The New York laws in general, that was backlash against mass migration of particularly of Italians and Jews.
And what was the reaction of the citizens when the federal government kind of started butting in with gun regulations and restricting certain guns?
When it got to something that was considered substantial by citizens, such as handgun restrictions, it was powerful to tell the federal government not to do it. So the The first instance of that at the federal level is President Roosevelt's attorney general was pushing something called the National Firearms Act, which would require federal taxation and registration on certain guns.
Just looking at present day right now, do you think that we are at a point right now where there's the most gun regulations we've ever had?
No, I'd say we have much less than we had. I mean, if you look at the number of words of federal law, that would be true. But I'd say we have less regulation in some ways than we did in much more dangerous high crime periods in American history, like the 70s and 80s. In 1975, the number of states where a law-abiding adult could carry a handgun in public places for lawful protection was only about a half dozen states like that. And now it's 42 states.
Thank you for speaking with me.
Okay, great. Thank you.
That was David Coppell with the Independence Institute at the University of Denver. Now I'm joined by Adam Winkler. He's a professor at UCLA and the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms.
Well, gun control is as old as the Second Amendment itself. The framers who wrote the Second Amendment had gun regulations prohibiting people from owning guns if they were not trustworthy. The framers included not only African-Americans and slaves, but also loyalists.
Were there any social movements that influenced gun regulations in the United States?
The growth of cities and the rise of 20th century immigration led to new gun control laws, helped motivate gun control laws in the 1920s and 30s, restricting who could carry guns on the streets. Part of that was built on a concern for foreigners who were carrying guns and were likely to use them at the spur of the moment. So some of that was racialized, some of that was xenophobic in nature. But not just that, there was a concern with the rise of the great cities. There was an increased effort in those cities to limit who could have guns on the streets.
And was this mainly state regulations?
Yes, for the most part. Although there were early forms of federal gun regulation, but not of the sort that we would recognize as restrictive gun laws. So, for instance, the Uniform Militia Act in the 1790s, a federal law passed by Congress, mandated that free citizens outfit themselves with a firearm.
Huh. The federal government started getting involved in 1934. Could you maybe just talk about that a little bit more?
Sure. Well, the National Firearms Act of 1934 was part of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal for crime. He not only had a New Deal for the economy, but also had what he called a New Deal for crime. And the National Firearms Act was part of that effort to build a broader federal law enforcement capacity.
And what was the reaction of the federal government trying to regulate guns?
Well, at first, the federal government's Roosevelt wanted to push for restrictions on even handguns. Gun owners, even back before the NRA was a powerhouse, were enough of a political force to stop that from happening. And there's really never been much of an effort since to significantly restrict handguns outside of a city here or a city there.
If we're looking at gun regulation that we have right now, would you say that it's the most restrictive?
I don't think so at all. I think that would be inaccurate. There's probably more gun laws today than there ever has been. And there's a variety of ways in which the gun industry is regulated much more than it was ever regulated previously. However, our laws are in many ways more permissive today than they were 100 years ago. Now, there's other ways in which we're more restrictive. We have background checks, which, of course, we didn't have for much of our history. So it's a complex story, but there are ways in which, in the push and pull of gun politics, there are ways in which our laws are looser than they were once before.
Adam Winkler, professor at UCLA and the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms. And before him, we heard from David Coppell with the Independence Institute at the University of Denver.
When we come back, we'll hear the story of a doe named 255. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. The longest mule deer migration route was recently discovered in Wyoming. Deer travel 150 miles from the Red Desert over the Wyoming Range to Hoback Junction near Jackson. But in 2016, wildlife biologists tracked one doe. She's known as number 255, trekking that distance plus another 92 miles into Idaho. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards sat down with the Wyoming Migration Initiative's director, Matt Kaufman, to hear the twists and turns of Doe 255's incredible story.
All of the deer sort of did what they were supposed to, but then this one deer, Deer 255, she went up to the Hoback and she stopped over in sort of the Granite Creek area for a few days, and then she just kept going. And she went basically over the Grovants, down into Jackson Hole, sort of skirted the edge of Jackson Hole around Jackson Lake, and then basically over the northern sort of foothills of the Tetons down towards the little town of Island Park in Idaho. And we saw this sort of happening in real time. And we thought, you know, this is very cool. However, there's at that point, we didn't know what was happening. So mule deer are, of course, well known for making long migrations. So that was one option. But the other thing that mule deer and other ungulates do is disperse. That is more rare, but it does happen. And dispersal is when, you know, we think of these animals as belonging to certain herds. But occasionally, animals will make a movement that puts them in a different herd and a different winter range. And so that was the other option, that maybe what we were seeing here is that that animal went up onto summer range, fell in with some different, you know, with a different group, and then just followed them to Idaho, in which case she would probably stay in Idaho for the rest of her life. And that would have been, you know, sort of interesting, Wyoming giving one of its deer to Idaho, but not as interesting as if that was her actual migration corridor. So that was June of 2016. Once she got there, she just set up shop on her summer home range, and she stayed there through the rest of June, the rest of July. And of course, all the time we're waiting to see, you know, we have to wait till the snow comes in the fall before it would push her to start her fall migration. But then in the first week of August, her collar failed. It was complete radio silence. You know, she was just lost.
So for the last year and a half, helicopters have been circling, listening for 255's radio collar. They told helicopter pilots to watch out for any brown collars, the color 255 was wearing. And if they saw deer in those collars...
We just said to the helicopter pilot, if you see any of those brown collars, just grab them. Just shoot the net over them and bring them in. And so he randomly saw a couple animals, no signal, just caught them, brought them in. And my graduate student had listened so frequently for Deer 55 that she'd memorized the serial number on the collar. And she looked at the collar, read off the serial number, and immediately knew that that was Deer 255. And so that was really exciting. And of course, what is exciting about it is that we now know, you know, we only knew part of the story before, that she went all the way to Island Park. It's like 240 miles. And finding her again on the winter range told us that she'd also come back.
255 wasn't just spunky. She was actually migrating, and migrating 100 miles farther than the farthest known mule deer migration route on Earth. And she's probably done it twice since they last heard from her. No one knows if she's doing it alone or in a small group.
And so she's now got a fresh new collar, so we'll be able to see if she retraces her steps and goes that 240 miles all the way back to Island Park, Idaho. She's actually already started migrating, so she's somewhere between Steamboat Mountain and Highway 28 last we checked in on her. And so, you know, we'll be watching her closely as this spring migration starts.
So, you know, what do you feel like the implications of 255 in this, you know, much longer migration route? What's kind of the takeaway from this whole thing?
These types of discoveries aren't possible in many other places in the West or many other places in the world. They're possible here in Wyoming because we still have wide open landscapes. We have a lot of public land. A lot of the private land that sort of stitches together these corridors, fortunately, is still maintained as large ranches, which animals can easily migrate through. So, you know, the fact that we can discover in 2018 a 240-mile migration in that runs through Wyomingites' backyards and Idahoans' backyards, really speaks to how intact and wild these landscapes still are.
That was Wyoming Migration Initiative's Matt Kaufman. He says this time, as Doe 255 migrates north to her summer range, she's doing it pregnant with twin fawns. Kaufman says it will be interesting to see whether she makes it back next year to her winter range with her young, and whether they, in turn, make this 240-mile trek. To see a map of 255's incredible journey, visit our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you want to hear it again, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. There, you can also find individual segments from the show, older programs, and sign up for our podcast. And a rater is our web editor.
If you have good ideas for future interviews or segments, you can also contact us through that website. Don't forget, you can stay abreast of daily news by following our Facebook page, and all of our reporters are on Twitter.
By the way, thanks to all of you who donated on behalf of Wyoming news coverage during the recent membership drive. It is greatly appreciated. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.